couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new movies Us, Gloria Bell, Triple Frontier, and a look back at Weird Al Yankovic's UHF. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring two Marys. We've got Mary Poppins Returns and Mary Queen of Scots. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can call me at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big piece of news that is hitting the movie world this week is that the Disney-Fox merger is finally complete. It happened right around midnight on, I think, Thursday morning, and now the Mouse House owns all of 20th Century Fox's TV and movies. Ever since the merger was announced, people have been bellyaching about this, worried because, oh my God, you know, conglomerations and everything's being consolidated under Disney, and Disney owns everything. They own Pixar, they own Star Wars, they own Marvel. The problem is, those aren't monopolies. It's not like Disney owns all of sci-fi. It's not like Disney owns all of comic books or even superheroes. Yes, they own Marvel, but Marvel's Marvel. The whole reason Marvel was spread around in the first place is Marvel was not owned by any of these one studios or any corporation, and they licensed to different productions. They licensed Sony. They got Spider-Man. I think they got Ghost Rider, and Fox got X-Men and Fantastic Four, and I think Universal had the Hulk. So it was all spread around, and then Marvel was purchased as an entity by Disney. And this is, I think part of this is Disney trying to get all of its properties under its roof so it can then do whatever it wants to do with Marvel. But this is just the same thing you have with DC. You do realize that Warner Brothers owns all of DC. Now, I imagine if Marvel or Disney were to try and purchase DC or Warner Brothers as a whole, that might start getting into some touchy territory. But then there's also all these independent comics out there that aren't owned by either Marvel or Warner Brothers that you can do. And I know there's a lot of people saying, oh, it's, you know, the fanboys who want to see Hulk fight Wolverine, they're the ones who are at fault. First of all, the fanboys who want Hulk to fight Wolverine, I haven't seen a lot of people cheering that in the fanboy universe, mainly because there's a lot of fanboys that don't like seeing the mainstreamifying of some of the comic book entities. And so there's criticism from the hardcore, you know, toxic masculinity fan base against that. So nobody wanted that in exchange to see Hulk fight Wolverine. But also those people aren't making those decisions. This is a decision at a corporate level for business by people way beyond the pay grade of your average comic book geek. Comic book geeks had no say in this. Now, there's a lot of things that are going to happen, and yeah, you do lose a lot of current productions. I think what people are more concerned about is the loss of the repertory titles. One of the things that Disney does not allow is it keeps a tight grip on its licensing of exhibition of its films. You know, a lot of times you can, the Alamo Drafthouse can show a movie, and as long as they get the license to do it, you know, usually you can get that. Usually you can clear that somehow. Disney is a little tighter on that license. So you may not be able to go to the Alamo Drafthouse and see Die Hard at Christmas. Who knows? They may not allow that to happen since now Disney owns Die Hard. Or the Alien, the original first two Alien movies, which were very easy to license and show. They're still going to release those on video. It's not going to be like those are out. Now, you may see some of the Fox titles going in and out of the vault, but Disney really only does that vault trick with their animated stuff. The stuff that you lose viewership because kids get too old. They put Lion King in the vault, and then they release it right when they're doing this remake, and Lion King's going to go in the vault in about 5 years. Well, I remember a couple years ago, I had a friend who was looking for the Lady and the Tramp movie. She couldn't find it, and it was super expensive to buy used because it was in the vault. And I told her, I said, just wait 2 years. It'll eventually come out of the vault and you can get it for $20. And she did that, and that happened. You may have to go to your VHS tapes to watch some of these things. But I mean, I don't think that the world's ending, because there's still Sony and Paramount and Universal and Warner Brothers, and all those are massive corporations themselves. Yes, they're shutting down Fox 2000, which is their sort of midline pictures. But let's face it, Fox 2000 hasn't been doing a lot of groundbreaking stuff. It's just sort of midland movies, average budgeted movies. And to assume that Disney only does blockbusters or micro budget is silly, because they have a whole Touchstone line and they have other things, and it comes and goes. And when that stuff is profitable, they do that again. So I'm not too worried about the Disney acquisition of Fox. I got a lot of stuff I like already on disc, and I don't go to repertory houses all that much to watch stuff. And I know that that makes me different than a lot of film nerds, but you know, there you have it. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. Let's leave a Disney discussion and jump into a new Disney's discussion with a look at the new trailer for Toy Story 4. Opens on June 21st.
Forky is the most important toy to Bonnie right now. We all have to make sure nothing happens to him.
Woody, we have a situation.
I am not a toy. I was made for soup, salad, maybe chili, and then the trash. Freedom!
Buzz, we've got to get Forky.
Affirmative.
Why am I alive?
You're Bonnie's toy. You are going to help create happy memories that will last for the rest of her life.
I'm not quite sold on this yet. And that's fine, because there have been plenty of Pixar movies where I've seen the trailer and been like, is that going to be any good? And then I see the movie and love it. The Incredibles was a great example. I thought the original, the very first trailer for The Incredibles back 15 years ago, I thought was clever but not great, because it didn't give you anything about the story. And The Incredibles ended up being one of my favorite animated films of all time. Toy Story, the original Toy Story, I remember back, what is that, 25 years ago? Are we 25 years almost from Toy Story? I remember seeing that in the 90s and being like, it looks like a kid's movie. And then I saw it and I loved it. So I can't completely judge this by the trailer. It does feel like it's an old bag of tricks trying to be recycled. I think there's this, you know, this whole thing with Forky, I think is cute, but it doesn't feel like it's major motion picture fourth in a series kind of work for that, because of course they're dealing with the young girl, and then they go off in the later in the trailer, they show them go off into the sort of this lost toys world where the lost toys go, and that looks kind of interesting. I just don't get the sense of the story yet. I see where they're going, and it looks like there can be some tender and wonderful moments, but it does seem like this trailer is a hodgepodge of gags and jokes that will get people interested in a younger age, but the true essence of a Pixar movie is the stuff that's in it that's not easily digestible in a two-minute trailer. The next one I want to hit really quickly is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which opens on July 26th.
So, Rick, explain to the audience exactly what it is a stunt double does.
Actors are required to do a lot of dangerous stuff. Cliff here is meant to help carry the load.
My hands are registered as lethal weapons. We get into a fight, I accidentally kill you, I go to jail.
Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter.
This is the ninth film from Quentin Tarantino, and I hate when they bill movies as the whatever's film from so-and-so, because I find that just so pretentious. I have a love-hate relationship with Quentin Tarantino. I think some of his movies are fantastic, like Pulp Fiction. I love The Hateful Eight. And then there's some of his movies I think are highly overrated. I think Reservoir Dogs is hot and cold. I think that Death Proof is kind of crap. Kill Bill was actually really good, but the first half was way better than the second half. And I think Inglourious Basterds, for as interesting of a movie as that was, it just was so long to get through with all the speeches. Nobody loves Quentin Tarantino's dialogue as much as Quentin Tarantino does. So this one looks like it's got some neat looks to it. The posters are terrible, but the trailer looks like it might be okay, but again, it gives you no sense of story. Sort of like this Toy Story trailer, it gives you no sense of story, no sense of how it all works together, and it might be quirky and fun in small parts, but will the whole hold together? And I thought, like The Hateful Eight did, we'll see about this one. That is it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Gloria Bell and Triple Frontier.
Thank you.
to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews with Gloria Bell. Julianne Moore stars as a divorced woman in her 50s who is getting back into the dating scene and takes some time for herself.
And then life just goes by in a flash like that.
I know. You tell me the same thing every 10 years. Love is in the air.
You come here a lot?
Yes, I mean, sometimes.
What's your name?
Gloria.
Happy birthday, sweetheart.
That's my ex-husband.
Then you were in love.
No.
Wasn't an easy situation.
Really?
I searched. I didn't exist.
Who is this guy, Mom?
This was in limited release, I think, for the last 2 weeks, but it's expanding into like 600 theaters this week. It's actually I wouldn't say a remake. It's a reimagining of the movie Gloria, which was a Chilean movie. But again, it's the same thing. It's about a woman later in life who's trying to get back in the dating world and having sexual relationships and meeting guys and trying to, you know, sort of spark a relationship after you guys both have adult kids and you want to know what goes on there. I happen to be still married. I'm in my late 40s. And my wife and I are happily married. We fight because everybody fights, but we're very content with each other and ourselves. And I hopefully won't have to do with this. I didn't like the dating scene in my 20s. I can't imagine how frustrated I would be in my 40s or 50s. But I think this is an interesting movie nonetheless, because it kind of takes a fly on the wall approach. Now, Julianne Moore, who, by the way, plays right at her age in the movie. I think she's like 58 in the movie. I think she's 58 in real life. God, if only everybody looked like Julianne Moore at 58. I mean, she looks fantastic at 58. And she's been very attractive all her life. But I'll tell you, it's funny watching this. And she's like, well, I'm 58. I'm divorced. And I'm like, yeah, you still got an edge on a lot of the other 58-year-old women out there because you're Julianne Moore. But she does a good job in it. It's really an acting spotlight on her. And, you know, there's not a big climax. There's not a big battle. It's not one against the other. It's just more a slice of life in these arcs of a relationship that she goes through, not just with men, like one of the men she dates is John Turturro, his character, and seeing how hard it is to find somebody who's compatible. And even if you find somebody who's compatible, you got to deal with their adult children and your adult children and their ex and your ex. And because it's more than just an ex, it's more than somebody you dated. It's somebody you lived with and had children with and were deeply in love with, and you are no more. And so it shows how more complicated things can get in that realm of late middle age. It's not a terribly intimate movie because it does, even the camera work is all very, it's subdued. It's back. Not as much as, say, like Roma was. Roma was a postcard movie. This one's sort of like medium two shots through the entire film. And I think that's done for a reason. And that's also the director. It's the same director who did A Fantastic Woman, the one that won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language. I think it was last year. He doesn't do up close and personal. He does sort of like, let's watch things happen from across the room. And in that sense, you get that sense in this movie as well. The reason to see this movie is for the acting. Julianne Moore is fantastic in it. She's very good. And John Turturro's good in it too. You've got people like Brad Garrett as her ex, and you got Michael Cera as her son. And he plays somewhat of a Michael Cera character, but he's not a spotlight to it. And it's weird because I just watched the end of Arrested Development season 5. And it's weird to see suddenly Michael Cera showing up. I'm like, are we back in 2005, 2007? So Gloria Bell is a neat movie. It is an art house movie, you know, so if you're going to go see it, realize what you're getting into. But, you know, it's worth it for the performances. I'm just surprised they didn't release it later because I could see this be an award contender for Julianne Moore, which would be great because women at her age don't always get, actresses at her age don't always get the opportunities, especially for something like this. So I'm going to have to say Gloria Bell kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Triple Frontier. Ben Affleck and Oscar Isaacs star as combat veterans who attempt to steal more than $75 million from a Colombian cartel leader.
You've been shot 5 times for your country, and you can't even afford to send your kids to college. If we had accomplished half the things that we've accomplished in any other profession, we'd be set for life. Huh. The question is, do we finally get to use our skills for our own benefit?
We're going to get Gabriel Martin Luria. He's got over $75 million in cash.
If we're not gone forever after you make your move, we are dead.
This is one of those high-end Netflix movies. You will find, if you follow Netflix in particular, every week they're dropping 10 or more pieces of original programming onto the service. And a lot of it are smaller movies, documentaries, foreign films that aren't really original programming. They acquired them. Like this week, the only thing that's new that's of real note is that Motley Crue docudrama, The Dirt. But there's still like a dozen other Netflix originals that are dropping this week that really nobody's paying attention to. Triple Frontier is one of those that they released in theaters. I think they released it in theaters because you got like a cast of Oscar Isaac, Ben Affleck. You have Garrett Hedlund, who's really not a, you know, theatrical guy, but Charlie Hunnam's in it. Pablo Pascal. You have a lot of names. You have a really good cast for this. It's also directed by J.C. Chandor, who did Margin Call and All Is Lost and A Most Dangerous Year. It's a movie that I think they're pushing to get a little bit more traction in the theatrical release. I think Netflix is inching into theatrical releases partly for survival's sake in order to compete at the award shows for stuff like Roma, because now they got Steven Spielberg gunning for him after the Roma won, came close to winning Best Picture, and they now want to sort of fiddle with the rules. So I think this is Netflix trying to spread this out more and get a little bit more establishment into theaters so they can do that. Now, this movie itself, it's an action movie, it's a military movie. It's sort of like a Colombian drug cartel real-life version of Ocean's 11. It's a heist movie in its sense, because you basically have these ex-soldiers going in as what would essentially be mercenaries hired by themselves to try and steal money from this drug lord and also kill the drug lord, because Oscar Isaacs runs the show and he's been trying to kill this guy for years, and so they want to go in and get him in his safe house. The problem I had with this, I mean, there was great acting. It's a neat idea. I just had problems with the characters. The characters get greedy. And they get greedy not because they're greedy. They get greedy because they get greedy in a stupid way. And I don't want to give anything away, but as you watch the movie, you're just like, okay, guys, you are getting greedy. You're unable to see an impossibility of a situation. And they make really, really terrible decisions. Even as trained soldiers, which they shouldn't. If they are that trained and well-trained, they should know how to handle certain things, and they don't. And they're sloppy, and they're greedy, and at times stupid. And it's unfortunate because they have such a great setup, and it gets really cheesy and corny as they, you know, wind down to the end of the movie. It does run a bit long as well. I wasn't terribly impressed with this. I know this is getting good reviews, but I got to say, I think that Triple Frontier actually kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Us and UHF. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with the movie reviews and talk about Jordan Peele's Us. This new thriller finds a family on vacation that are confronted by their doppelgangers trying to steal their lives.
What are you people?
It's us.
They look exactly like us. They think like us. They know where we are. We need to move and keep moving. They won't stop until they kill us. Or we kill them.
This is highly anticipated because a lot of people want to know, was Jordan Peele a one-hit wonder with Get Out? Because Get Out, I mean, that thing was a juggernaut. It came out and did extremely well. It made tons of money, really put him on the map as a director. And then it got Academy Award nominations, too. It didn't really win any, but it got a lot of a love at the end of the year. People remembered it all the way through the year. And it was one of those movies, kind of like A Quiet Place last year, that was a huge hit in the beginning of the year that nobody expected it. Now, of course, if Us is a big hit, it's not as big of a surprise because everybody's got their eyes on Jordan Peele. What I find so fascinating, just on the surface, before we even get to the movie, is Jordan Peele is best known for comedy. I mean, he did Key and Peele, and he did a lot of, Mad TV and stuff like that. But these movies are not funny. I mean, even if the Golden Globes is going to try and pigeonhole Get Out as a comedy because it has satirical or whimsical moments, that doesn't mean it's an actual comedy. I would not declare that a comedy. I certainly would not say Us is a comedy. Us is a straight-up horror movie. That is not a whimsical film at all. But if you know any comedians, you will know that comedians tend to be really dark people. And the only thing that keeps them funny is they're able to make light of it on stage. That darkness of Jordan Peele's mind makes this work. And to a certain degree, I'm kind of interested to see what ends up happening with this new reboot of The Twilight Zone that he is at least hosting. I don't know how much involvement he's going to have, but I like his twisted brand of horror. Now, Us, at its surface, the beginning, it's a straight-up take on the home invasion thriller. And that works. It absolutely works. Just like Dawn of the Dead works as a straight-up zombie movie, or Invasion of the Body Snatchers works as a straight-up alien invasion movie. But both of those have subtext. You know, Invasion of the Body Snatchers was about McCarthyism. And Dawn of the Dead was about consumerism and mob mentality. And even when Romero made Day of the Dead, that was saying things about the military-industrial complex, even though it was a movie about zombies. And I think that that's not necessarily required in any horror movie, but it works. So the original Dracula story was about blood diseases at its core. I mean, it was about vampires, but it was about blood diseases like syphilis. That's what the spark for Bram Stoker was for the original Dracula before it even was into a movie, before movies even existed. Get Out was very clear what he was doing. It was very much on the surface that he was doing an allegory and he was making statements about cultural appropriations and the allure of the minority, but keeping the minority down at the same time. And there's an ownership issue. So there's a lot of interesting stuff that's in Get Out from a cultural perspective, but it's all on the surface. It's pretty easy to dissect that. Us is very different. And yes, Us works as a straight-up horror movie, and it goes bigger than just this little home invasion. There's more to it. I don't want to say much more because I don't want to give anything away. I don't want to be spoilery, but it's more than just a home invasion movie. There's an explanation behind this. Now, he does run into some problems in the third act with delivering that explanation, and like there's a twist that I saw coming from the beginning of the movie, but it still works. I'm not going to fault him for some wonky moments in a third act when the rest of the movie is so well constructed. There is a lot he's saying in this movie, and it's clear. There's one line in there that makes it clear that you can't misconstrue it as saying, well, this is all accidental. But what he's saying, exactly what he's saying, is kind of buried in there. And you really have to deconstruct the movie. Now, I've heard critics say, oh, I know what it's talking about, and it's a great commentary on XYZ. I don't necessarily think it is. I think a lot of it's, you need to interpret it partly for yourself, you know, like a doppelganger, you're looking in the mirror, and you need to put it on your own filter. Now, I know Jordan Peele came out at South by Southwest and did a talk on it after the screening, and he was a little cagey about talking about the meaning. He kind of hit some points, but I hope he does a Stanley Kubrick on this and just kind of doesn't explain it. It's better to not explain it because then this movie will live, and this movie can be deconstructed and discussed and looked at again and again and again to really catch a deeper meaning from it. And I think he does a great job burying that in there. Like I said, much deeper and more intertwined with the story than he did with Get Out. From a construction of a film, this is actually a step up from Get Out, even with those third act problems, it's a really well done movie. I'm going to have to say it's one of my more interesting movies I've seen in a long time. The one that's going to stick with me. I'm going to have to say that Us totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about a retro comedy. That is UHF. In this absurd 80s comedy, Weird Al Yankovic plays a slacker who is put in charge of a failing UHF station only to make it the most popular station in town.
Channel 62 has the lowest ratings in the history of television. What they need is a new station manager. What they get is a man so desperate, he'll put anyone on the air.
Hey, Stanley.
Yeah, George?
How would you like your own TV show?
Okay.
He's Conan the Librarian.
Today we're teaching poodles how to fly.
We beat out the networks. We're the number one station in town.
One of the reasons why I do these retro reviews is a lot of times there are movies that I just sort of stumble onto. And there's always something you can glean from an old film. This is available on Amazon Prime. This movie is a movie that you couldn't make and understand today. Because this was back at the time where, yeah, you had cable, but a lot of people just had broadcast TVs. And if you had a TV like you're a kid, like I had a TV, a black and white TV in my room, and you could catch UHF stations. Now, I lived in Columbus, Ohio. My family's from Cleveland. They had a ton of independent stations. And a lot of those independent stations, that was where the really cool stuff was happening for the younger generation. That's where you'd go find all the reruns. That's where you'd go find the movies that they'd show either late at night or in the morning or the cartoons. They wouldn't just show the network cartoons. They showed like Laurel and Hardy movies or Three Stooges comedies. Those were those stations that I loved watching when I was in Cleveland as a little kid visiting my family. And you don't have that anymore. You have UHF stations around, but cable and internet and YouTube, it makes it all kind of obsolete. But back then, this was kind of a dream of mine. And as much as I have said earlier that I'm not a big fan of going to repertory showings of movies, because I don't care whether it's on film or it's digitally projected or if I'm watching it across the living room at my house, I had a lot of love for this nostalgia of the old-fashioned UHF station. And a guy who could run his own station, that was like a kid's dream come true. At my age, a teenager, I mean, I would have loved to do that. Now, they also make jokes in here where they kind of swerve into tabloid TV and like kids shows like Kramer from Seinfeld before he became Kramer. Michael Richards stars in it as this guy who does a kid's show. This is the kind of thing that I would have loved to have done as a kid. You know, it's sort of like watching the original Fright Night with Roddy McDowell playing that late night horror movie host, which you really don't get. Now, yeah, you got Svengoolie on whatever station he's on, but that's more kitsch. Now, I mean, that was like a staple of local late night shows that you don't have anymore. And so this is a throwback. Now, it's absurd and silly, and there's a lot of gags and jokes, and there's this weird moment where they have to do a Weird Al Yankovic video because that's what he was famous for, especially back then. But it's a funny movie. It has some silly moments. It has some crazy moments. It has some really out-of-the-box absurd things, especially what they do with Tony Gary, Luke Spencer from General Hospital, who's in the movie. They give him a weird little part. But this is on the level of like an earnest movie, only not aiming for such a younger audience. I absolutely had a blast rewatching UHF. I probably liked it more now for the nostalgia added to the fact that it's just a cute little funny movie. And so I'm going to have to say UHF rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the box office and the home cinema roundup featuring a merry double feature of Mary Poppins Returns and Mary Queen of Scots.
Just eat it, eat it. Get yourself an egg and beat it.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. We're done with the movie reviews of the new films, well, and the old one, UHF. But let's jump into the box office and talk about what happened last week. Captain Marvel, of course, came in on top. It made almost $70 million for its second weekend, which, to be fair, that's a great second weekend for this movie. It's like over $700 million worldwide. It's probably going to be well over $300 million by the time I'm done talking. So that one did really well. I imagine it's going to fall to Us, because Us has got so much anticipation against it because of Jordan Peele and the allure of Get Out. And it's a good movie, and it did really well in previews. So, I mean, Captain Marvel losing to Us in its third weekend is not a bad thing at all. That's still wonderful news for Captain Marvel and for Us. Last week, though, Wonder Park came, I think it actually defied expectations and came in close to $16 million, which was a little more than they expected, but that's still kind of not a good number for a big animated film. 5 Feet Apart came in with $13 million, which is also not great. I mean, coming in at third, just buried under a bunch of movies, is not great for even the disease of the week romance, but nothing came in bad like Captive State, which was just over $3 million for the whole weekend. To put that in perspective, Us made more than double that in just an evening of shows for its Thursday nights, whereas Captain State only made $3.1 million over the entire weekend. Not good at all for that movie. I think a lot of that has to do with a couple things. I think one of them is Captive State has that terrorism flip on the card that I think isn't something that a whole lot of people wanted. Plus, it just flew under the radar. I don't think a whole lot of people knew this was going on. And there's so much that they kept the aliens out of the movie that you couldn't even put them marginally in the trailer to entice people to come see a science fiction movie. Otherwise, it just looks like, an occupation movie, which doesn't have to be aliens. It was a tough sell, and I'm not surprised that it did so poorly in the box office. Who knows? Maybe it'll have a little bit of life on DVD and Blu-ray or streaming and home video. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. We've got two Marys we're going to be talking about. The first one I want to talk about is the new one for the week, and that is Mary Poppins Returns. Emily Blunt takes on the role of the magical nanny who returns to the adult Banks children when they need help with their own kids.
I was flying the kite and I got called on a nanny!
Mary.
Poppins, you came back.
You seem hardly to have aged at all.
Really? One never discusses a woman's age, Michael. Would have hoped I taught you better.
After all this time.
Same thing that brought me the first time. I've come to look after the Banks children.
Us?
Oh, yes, you too.
One of the things that was interesting about Mary Poppins Returns is it was still good that Disney released it for its box office, released it at Christmas. It feels like a Christmas movie. It fit in the theaters well. I don't think there was too much fighting against it in for the specific audience. And Christmas movies tend to have longer legs, so they have box office that extends into January. And this movie made enough money. It's totally fine. It wasn't a massive hit. It wasn't a juggernaut, but I don't think they were expecting it to be. But I think the most wonderful thing about this movie was how much they made it like the original Mary Poppins. Yeah, they had dirt bikes doing tricks in it, which was kind of stupid, but they had a movie that patterned itself after Mary Poppins. You had the big street urchins dance song like Step in Time. You had, I think it was Trip the Light Fantastic. And you had the fantasy elements with the cell animation that was put in with computers, but it still preserved that ink and paint style and look that the original Walt Disney production had. Plus, you know, it felt like it was paced very similarly. And that's something that I think it stung it a little bit with a modern audience, because a modern audience wants a kid's movie to move faster. The original Mary Poppins does not move fast. It does drag. But I thought Emily Blunt did a great job in it. And it's just a fun, charming movie. I think this is a kind of film that does work as one of those sequels made many, 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 many years ago. Whereas like Fantasia 2000 doesn't hold up as being as fantastic as the original Fantasia was, or as groundbreaking as the original Fantasia was, but it still works as a 1-2 punch to watch the two of them together. It's kind of neat to watch both of those. Mary Poppins Returns, I think, it certainly feels like it has a lot of connective tissue with the first one. Now, the special features it has, like most Disney releases, it's not loaded with like commentaries and heady film school stuff, because it's essentially a family movie. But they've got about an hour of bonus features, which have a sing-along edition, and they have deleted scenes and this deleted song, which in general Disney fashion, it's a lot of sketches that you have to watch the song with. But they've got bloopers, and they've got some behind-the-scenes making of some of the production numbers, making of the movie itself. They also have some neat little interviews just one-on-one with the cast peppered in there through there and the production team that kind of shows how they took care to make it a worthy sequel of Mary Poppins. And I think that's the stuff that I appreciated most about it is this wasn't some egomaniacal director doing his own take on Mary Poppins. It reminded me a little bit of how Blade Runner 2049, Denis Villeneuve made a real point to make that a direct sequel to Blade Runner and to honor the original. And I felt that Rob Marshall was doing the same way with Mary Poppins Returns. So I'm going to have to say that Mary Poppins Returns, the Blu-ray, rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. It's a couple weeks late, but let's hit Mary Queen of Scots and talk about that on Blu-ray. Saoirse Ronan stars as Mary Stuart, a member of the Scottish royalty who has a claim to the throne held by Queen Elizabeth I.
Mary is our foe. We must never bow to her as we bow before you.
You have the boldness to doubt my judgment.
She is only your queen if I should not produce an heir.
What is it like
to have a man?
With heaven's blessing, we bring an heir to Scotland and to England.
It is a clear provocation.
We must make war in Scotland.
So put your skills to use.
I saw this in theaters, and it was real dense for me because it's got a lot of politics. And the way politics worked back then, as I described it, I said it's a lot of people in castles trying to decide who's going to marry whom. And there's a lot of players, and there's a lot of this person helping that person, and the family trees are complex. And then you got advisors coming in and religious leaders. It was a little hard to follow because I don't know the history. Now, my father's a big history buff, especially European history, and he had been waiting to see Mary Queen of Scots for months. And I finally got a chance to show it to him on the Blu-ray, and it was neat for him to see it because I could kind of judge the movie as somebody who knew the players going in. Because at this point, when I watched a movie, I knew Margot Robbie was Queen Elizabeth. I knew Saoirse Ronan was Mary Stuart. And then I knew Doctor Who, David Tennant, was John Knox, the religious leader. Not Johnny Knoxville, but John Knox, who was the religious leader who was pushing the Catholic versus Protestant angle. And it's beautifully shot. It's a gorgeous movie, but it does remind you that, yeah, it's just a bunch of... Even though, like, the highest level, even the Queen of England, the Queen of all that is England... lives in squalor by today's standards. Same thing with the Queen of Scotland, Mary Queen of Scots. She's royalty, and she just is surrounded by yes men in these dingy castles. And you'd say even if you were the richest of the rich, you'd live in a pretty awful conditions, which I always find interesting about these historical pieces. My father, because he's such a history nut, he enjoyed watching it because he liked watching the political intrigue and the political battles that are going on, sometimes not a physical battle, but just behind the scenes. But even he was a little bit confused at times. He said it was hard to follow who was who and which players. He's basically saying he needs to go back and brush up on his history of Mary Queen of Scots and Queen Elizabeth and who was who at the time in order to really fully evaluate the movie, which that's sort of like the historical version of saying, well, to really understand the movie, you need to read the comic book or you need to read the book series. You know, it's sort of like if you went and saw Lord of the Rings and somebody says, well, to really fully understand Lord of the Rings, you got to read all those books and the Hobbit book and then all the appendices and the extra stuff that no, you should be able to go see a movie and get it. And I think that's the thing that held Mary Queen of Scots back. As beautifully done as it was and as great of acting as it was, my review still stands that it was a little hard to follow and to understand the importance of every little bitty thing that was going on. But still, Mary Queen of Scots has some decent bonus features, some historical features that let you in more on the history of it, like Tudor feminism and something about Mary's, and there's a feature commentary. So there's at least some stuff that will enrich it on the Blu-ray. So I'm going to have to say that Mary Queen of Scots, the Blu-ray, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that's it for this week. I need to go. Next week, we're going to be talking about the Disney remake of Dumbo. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.